Hi there, Jonathan here. The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied access to these practices and to these teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to support this offering, you can go to my website where you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter designed to support you in your practice. That's at www.jonathanfaust.com. Thank you and enjoy. So I've been giving a few talks on the topic of wise action, how to move from stuck places to wise action, and tonight's talk is on conflict, moving from conflict to wise action. So as I was doing some research for this talk, exploring conflict, inevitably it led to mediation. And then I found initially to my delight that there are all these mediation jokes. And then I found to my chagrin that they're terrible jokes. I couldn't figure out why, but then I realized as mediators, they're just terrified of offending anyone. So they're just not funny at all. But I'll share the best one with you. This big record producer rang a mediator and said, "Could you help me? I need someone to come straight away because the band U2 are in the middle of recording their next album and they can't agree on anything. The only thing they can agree on is that they would use a mediator, but no one's willing to pay. Could you do it pro bono?" That was the best one. So don't look to mediation jokes for your next, party. So really, I'd like to talk about four things tonight, and hopefully there'll be something relevant in here. If you have any conflicts, you might want to explore. Just to talk about the nature of conflict, to talk about the fundamental source of conflict, which is ignorance, the nature of letting go, and the nature of karma, of really looking at cause and effect as you evaluate the conflicts you might be stuck in your life. I once had this great idea. I thought it was a great idea for a movie. It'd be an action movie, kind of a thriller, with chases and fights and all that stuff. And so it opened with a hero dressed in a suit on his way to make contact, for all the goods on some evil corporate person. On his way there, he's shadowed by two henchmen, and he leads them down an alley, and of course, beats them up and leaves them and goes on. And as the film goes on, all kinds of action and so forth. But the twist would be that the second half of the movie would be going back and spending a minute with each of the people he had beaten up. So you'd be visiting them in physical therapy or with their therapists, talking about their PTSD and interviews of, yes, the tubes come out next week, I'm really excited. And I thought it'd be interesting, but it'd also be amazingly boring. Because what sells is conflict. That's the fuel of what makes life so interesting. What's what makes a movie interesting? What's what makes literature interesting? And it's curious, as you think about your life right now, on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you place your personal level of drama? It'd be interesting to do a little check-in and see how many of us are up at the peak of 7 and 8, how many of us maybe a little bit lower. But I think we all carry some inner tension. And that inner tension you might have in your personal conflicts, it's an edge. There's some edge. And you can think of it as a growing edge. Conflict is something calling your attention where it's stimulating you in some way to grow, potentially. So the author Steven Pinker came out with a book, I think a year or two ago, called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And he made the case that the world is becoming dramatically less violent than it was before. But it doesn't seem that way. And I think part of it is because we have so much access to information. And maybe, I don't know, maybe if we are possibly evolving as a species, and I'm not saying we are, but possibly, that we're just more sensitized to the violence and the conflict in our world right now. The Foreign Policy Institute outlined the top 10 global conflicts for this year. And we all know about Syria and Iraq, Turkey, Yemen, the Greater Sahel and the Lake Chad Basin, the Congo, South Sudan, Afghanistan, Myanmar right now, the Ukraine. And when you look at the nature of these conflicts, oftentimes there are tensions between groups, a dominant culture and non-dominant culture, or there's a lack of resources. And a fundamental nature of conflict is the failure to understand the other party. And of course, movies and literature feast on conflict. It's what makes a good story. So as an English major, former English major, I couldn't help but to think about the classic conflict that informs literature and movies. One is, we used to say man versus, but we'll say person versus fate or God. So a lot of the myths are based on this, you know, humans versus the gods. So we have the Odyssey, for example, or Oedipus Rex, which reminded me of one of the first limericks I ran across as a kid, which I'll share with you. The play about Oedipus Rex has a plot that is very complex. He clobbered his paw, had sex with his ma, while the chorus sang songs about sex. Another theme is person versus self. It's if you look at Hamlet, it's a classic example of someone torn internally, to be or not to be. Should I just die or should I fight? The conflict of person versus person. You know, the movie Kramer versus Kramer, two people in conflict, fighting it out. Person versus society. The movie Erin Brockovich is a great example of that. One person fighting the energy corporation Pacific Gas and Electric. Person versus nature. All the disaster films that are out there. Or the classic Moby Dick or Castaway with Tom Hanks. It was just Tom Hanks and nature. And then person versus the supernatural. And if Mary Shelley's Frankenstein or the movie Predator, which was described as a team of commandos in a jungle meet an extraterrestrial warrior, followed by the movie Predators, which was described as a team of commandos in a jungle meet multiple extraterrestrial warriors. And then finally, we have person versus technology. So 2001, classic example. Open the pod bay doors, Hal. That line. Dave, I'm afraid I can't do that. So conflict is part of life. And we see it externally. We see it on the planet. We see it in literature. We see it in movies. It's the fuel that kind of keeps things interesting. But what these practices say, that when you are in conflict, you need to, rather than look outside, look inside. And that's what the practice is all about. It's about really learning to explore and take ownership for your experience and then to develop your capacity to sense another person's experience. So here's a story from a mediator I thought was interesting. The bailiff unlocked the small courtroom. After telling me to make myself at home, he pointed to a small red button on the wall. "If you need me, just press that button and I'll be here faster than you can blink an eye. It's an emergency button." "Okay, thanks," I replied as I began to unpack my briefcase. "I mean it," he said. "Just press the button. Maybe you should set up your chair so you're near it." I gave him a long look. "You seem to want me to know about that button. Is there something else you want to tell me?" I was about to mediate a messy estate dispute between family members who'd been winding their way through the legal system for a couple of years. As a probate mediator for the state of New Hampshire, I had no prior contact with my parties, something that's quite different than what I mediate in the workplace. All I typically knew about a situation was the general nature of the dispute and how many people were involved. Sometimes I received materials from the attorneys involved and sometimes not. The bailiff crossed his arms and set a wide stance with his legs. "Well, one of the fellows has been a big problem in the courtroom, cursing at the judges, really belligerent and disrespectful, out of control. You're going to have your hands full because his lawyers can't manage him either." He gestured toward the button again and left me alone. About an hour into the mediation, there was a knock on the door, and the bailiff leaned his head into the room. "Everything okay in here?" I nodded and he left. Another hour and he checked again. "We're all fine," I told him. "Thanks, but you don't need to check in." "And please don't," I thought to myself, and he didn't. As I packed my briefcase a few hours later, after the parties had signed their agreement and left, the bailiff wandered in. "It was awfully quiet in here," he commented. "I kept waiting for that fellow to start his hollering. It worried me when I didn't hear any disturbance, so that's why I checked on you. How did you get him under control?" I almost laughed. He checked in on me because it was so normal and quiet in the room, he imagined something had just happened to me. It was very kind of him, actually. "How did I get him under control?" I said. "By not even trying. He didn't need anyone to control him. He needed someone to really listen and try to understand him. When he got that, he didn't need to yell anymore." It's that kind of listening that we have to engage into when we're in conflict, to ourselves and to others. I've mentioned this before, but have you ever in your life been in an argument and then realized at some point that you're wrong? It's a powerful Zen pop quiz. Like how quickly can you, when you recognize it, actually own it? And I've met quite a few people in life who simply can't own it. They'll defend it going all the way down. And I've done that myself, to be honest. Recognizing I'm wrong and I just can't acknowledge it. When you're in conflict, it generally means you have to let go of something. And it usually has to do with your point of view. And when you can't let go, when you're in conflict and it doesn't shift, there's something in conflict mediation called the retaliatory spiral. Basically, you're giving a person a taste of their own medicine, if you've ever done that. "So you're not going to respond to my emails? Well, I'll just freeze you out and give you a taste of your own medicine. Oh, so you won't listen to me? Well, I'm not going to listen to you." We have these strategies that we all unconsciously engage into to either dominate or avoid domination. Either we use anger as a way to gain dominance through aggression. I know someone who, whenever he was in a potential conflict, he would insult them just to get them off balance and then assert his dominance. And I saw him do it again and again and again. Sometimes the strategy is just to accommodate. You just prioritize the other person's well-being. Try to soothe them, try to please them, to kind of appease them. Another strategy is avoidance. You just disengage and hope the conflict goes away. It's my specialty. And then the other is to be passive-aggressive, where you'll either not respond or you'll sabotage the person behind their back, talk trash about them when they're not there. Maybe one of these tactics might resonate for you of your own pattern. When we can own up to our patterns in conflict, when we can own at least our side of the equation, then there's the possibility of compromise and collaboration. But it requires a pretty powerful shift in perspective. And the question is, how can you make that shift? As Einstein said, no problem was ever solved in the same consciousness that created it. So something has to shift when you're in conflict. I ran across this piece, which talks about the attitude that's required when you're in conflict with another. There was a father who left 17 camels as an asset for his three sons. When the father passed away, his sons opened up the will. And the will of the father stated that the eldest son should get half of the 17 camels, while the middle son should be given a third, and the youngest son should be given a ninth. As it's not possible to divide 17 into half, or 17 by 3, or 17 by 9, the three sons started to fight with each other. How could they possibly divide the father's inheritance? So the three sons decided to go see a wise counsel. And this man listened patiently about the whole matter of about dividing the 17 camels. One half to the eldest, one third to the middle, one ninth to the youngest. How is it possible to do this? So this wise man, after giving him thought, brought one camel of his own and added it to the 17. That increased the total to 18 camels. And now he started reading the deceased father's will. Half of 18 was 9. One third of 18 was 6. One ninth of 18 was 2. Now if you add this up, 9 plus 6 plus 2 is 17 and leaves one camel, which the wise man took back. So the punchline of the story is to find the 18th camel, to find the common ground. Once you can find the common ground, there's a possibility of some resolution. It's not easy, but if you're in conflict and you believe there's not a solution, you probably won't find one. So a short little reflection, if you will. If you like, you can close your eyes, and you might take a moment to reflect on someone with whom you are in conflict. And you might, as you settle on one particular conflict to explore, you might take a moment just to reflect on what it feels like inside when you feel caught or stuck. How long has this conflict been going on? And you might ask yourself, is it possible to find a solution here? Do you believe it's possible? And you might take a moment to explore a little role reversal. How would the other person describe the situation? Is there a sense of what the other person is needing or wanting that's not happening? And is there a sense of what it might be like for them if that need or wish was met? So kind of leaving that there, if you like, you can deepen your breath, and if you like, you can open your eyes. Doing a role reversal can always be informative. The willingness to imagine what it's like through another person's eyes. But it's also really important in conflict to take full responsibility for your own experience. And so that requires really honestly paying attention to your side of the equation. Generally, wherever there's conflict, there's an automatic reflexive movement to justify your position and then blame the externals. It just happens. It's just the formation of the self, of who you are. But just as when you take a close look at anger, you may realize that underneath the anger can be a multiple of other feelings. There can be hurt, there can be disappointment, there can be shame, there can be sadness. In that same way, when you explore a conflict you're in, it's very, very helpful to look closely at everything you're holding inside as well. Inevitably, we have our ways of self-protection. A lot of conflict that many people find in their life, at least recently I've noticed this in conversations with people, is after the parents die, if the will isn't really, really clear, those old patterns come up. You know, my sister always got what she wanted, not this time. I'm going to stand up for myself. Or someone saying, you know, just because my little brother never got his life together doesn't mean I should be giving up anything to support him. I've been responsible in my life. You know, I'm not going to be submissive anymore. This is my time to stand up. Those patterns run so deep, and they're so hard to move through. In that same way, when you explore your side of the equation in a conflict, it really requires you drill really deep. Those feelings of self-protection, how old are they? How far back do they go? It's really important. So if you like, you can close your eyes again. When you reflect on this conflict, you might take a few moments just to soften on the inside and sense if you can locate what it feels like. How does your body hold this conflict? Can you locate what that feels like inside? Are there any emotional words that resonate with this feeling? how many emotions can you name or recognize as you explore the nature of this conflict inside? And you may take some time to reflect on the unmet need. What are you wanting here? What are you hoping for that's not happening? Can you name that? And regarding this conflict, how do you want to feel? What is the outcome that would be most desirable for you? And if you like, you can deepen the breath again. And if you like, you can open the eyes. Acknowledging the true deep emotions associated with this can be very helpful, just to see them clearly. And the courage to really name what you're wanting, what you're hoping for, can be helpful. And a very helpful question is to ask yourself how you want to feel about this. What is the ultimate feeling you'd like to cultivate? In working with a woman who was in a dispute over a will, when I asked her how she wanted to feel, she said, "I want to feel like justice was done." And for her, it felt really powerful to stand up for herself after a lifetime of sort of like holding back and a sort of appeasement thing. For others, how they want to feel may be different. You know, I just want to feel free. I just want to let this go. But what it leads to is really key in conflict resolution, and that is really having a clear intention. And it really leads to really kind of back to kind of the basics of cause and effect or the law of karma. I remember when I was maybe 7 or 8 and I first heard the golden rule, do unto others as they would have you do unto you. And it was just this revelation for me. It seemed so clean. I remember thinking, this is amazing. If everyone did this, it would be fantastic. And it is amazing. If we could treat others as we would want to be treated. And so it becomes a very interesting inquiry when you're in conflict, and inevitably in conflict you have created an enemy. You have created an other. To really ask yourself how you would want to be treated and what it might be like to treat the other in that way. And there are some other questions you can ask yourself. So we'll do another little reflection if you like. So when you again bring your attention to this conflict, how would you most like to be treated in this relationship? And what would it feel like if you were to treat the other as you would like to be treated? Just to take a few moments to kind of play that out. A few more inquiries. In regard to this conflict, what are you focusing on? On short term or long term? What is your motivation in this conflict? Is it fear? Or is it creating new possibilities? What do you want to create? What do you want to feel? And reflecting on this final question, how do you want the other person to perceive you? And the final question, regarding this conflict, what advice do you have to give yourself? And if you'd like, you can deepen the breath. And you can open your eyes. You know, when it comes to spiritual practice, there are lots of different philosophies. In yoga philosophy, there's the philosophy of Samkhya yoga that basically says that this world is illusion. It's just pure illusion. So don't go there. Stay away from the world because it's just going to pull you into empty suffering. And so from that tradition, which is not just yoga, but it's, you look at Catholic priests, it's about pulling yourself away, not engaging. Monks, priests are all about sort of pulling back to, so you don't get caught in this world of illusion. And there's something to that. As we used to say in the ashram, no car, no car problems. No relationship problems. But then there's another philosophy really counter to that, which is exploring what it means to be in the world, fully engaged in your relationships and your commitments, and to cultivate an unbroken connection to presence, to cultivate an unbroken connection to non-judging awareness. And as I've shared before, when I was on my way to do this very, very intensive training, I stopped in at an ashram. And I met with the guru. I told him where I was going. This very, very intense, reclusive training. I was very, very excited. I've been planning on it for years and years. And he listened to me quite generously. And he said, you can go to a cave and learn all kinds of powers. But if you leave the cave and walk down the street and someone insults you, what good are the practices? He said, what about a life where you engage fully into your life and then you bring yourself out in your practice to disengage, to cultivate non-judging awareness, and then engage again into your life? And that made a lot of sense to me. And I think that really is the life that we're living. Is it possible in all of your commitments and all the craziness of all your relationships to fully engage and then have some kind of practice, whatever it is for you, as a way of pausing, as a way of calling yourself back so you can refresh and reboot, clarify what's most important, and then return again to your particular mission and purpose in life. These conflicts we find ourselves in are incredible growth opportunities. Any edge you feel in relationship and in conflict has the possibility of either shutting you down or the possibility of shifting your consciousness in some way, shifting your mind and heart in some way, that you might find some solution to create some kind of new possibility in your life. That's what life presents us. It's the possibility for creating new possibilities. But it's so important to recognize that you need ways to pause. With every intention to be compassionate, there is something that is now quantified called compassion fatigue. You can only handle so much before you need to rest and renew and recharge. So the most important question, or at least one of the most important questions, is what feeds you so that you can wake up each day and look forward to your day? At one point, I was the president of this large, crazy organization, 350 employees, and I hired a consultant from Deloitte Touche to work with me. And I initially thought that I had hired him as someone I could complain to. And he was a really, really wise fellow. And then he said, you know, if you can't wake up looking forward to the day, maybe you should quit. Maybe this job isn't for you. And that was a real wake-up call for me. And I realized that I needed to adjust my attitude in a really big way. And I realized I really did want to find a way to make this happen. So it was quite a profound shift. But it really does bring up that question of what would you need, what would fuel you in a way so that you can wake up and look forward to the day ahead. There are lots of different practices out there. Lots of different traditions will tell you what to do in order to fill your cup so it's overflowing. But it is truly a deeply, deeply personal inquiry to wire that up for yourself. What is it in your life that is going to help you to pause, refresh, renew, so that you can engage in a way where you can keep your heart open? There is the Bodhisattva vow, which is a very powerful tool. It has been for me. Tara and I incorporated into our wedding vows. And one version goes like this. May whatever arise serve the awakening of heart and mind and be of benefit to all beings. There have been a couple times in my relationship when I was feeling resentful or hurt, and I remember that. And it really made a difference. You know, may this experience serve the awakening of heart and mind and be of benefit to all beings. Embracing that, for me, has been a very, very helpful way to see the conflicts in my life as opportunities for growth, as imperfect as I may be with all of mine. So thank you for your time and attention. I hope this might be helpful in some way as you explore navigating the conflicts of your life. Why don't we'll do a short yet brief meditation and then announcements and cookies. So you might take a long, deep breath, close the eyes. As you sense the challenges in your life, just reflecting on these words. May whatever arise serve the awakening of heart and mind and be of benefit to all beings. When you're ready, you can let your eyes open. And thank you again for your kind attention. A couple of quick announcements. There's a mindful discussion group happening. Please feel free to join in. Tea and cookies, if you'd like to hang out for a little while. Yoga beforehand, as always, the book club. And as always, thanks for your generous support that keeps this whole thing rolling forward. May you and all your conflicts have a wonderful evening, and I'll see you next week.